The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. Not necessarily an enviable position, being the conscience of psychiatry. But one of the good things about it is the good friends, the responsible professionals that you get to know sharing the reform impulse. Today's guest is going to deal with one of the most critical issues in psychiatric reform. How in the world can we get enough people off psychiatric drugs? All over the world, people are clamoring to find a way to reduce their meds or to stop their meds. When they go to prescribers, family doctors, pediatricians, psychiatrists, pediatricians, of course, in the case of children, their families go to the pediatrician and they say, "I think these drugs aren't working, doc. These drugs are, they seem to be doing some harm. He hasn't been himself. I think he's getting worse, doc. Getting worse and worse now." Almost always, the response in modern world of medicine is more drugs, new drugs, more drugs, new drugs. Bigger doses, greater numbers. When a courageous patient or parent says, "I really want you to help in reducing my child's medication or my medication," too often the response they'll get is hostile and angry, or, "Okay, if that's what you want," and then cold turkey, which causes so much anguish and distress to the individual that they come back believing the doctor was right. They can't do without the medication, when in fact they could do fine without it if they were given a reasonable taper. Now, what is a reasonable taper is one of the things we'll discuss today. How to go about the whole process will be the subject of a good part of today's discussion. My guest is my friend, my good friend, Sartan Weinraub. That's W-E-I-N-R-A-U-B, Weinraub, Dr. Sartan Weinraub. You can get him in the phone book in New York City. He'll tell you how else to go about getting him. And he runs a clinic in a beautiful setting. It's really a lovely building and a lovely garden, no less, downtown Manhattan. Sartan, hello. Sartan, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Can you hear me?
Hi. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Yes, very good.
Well, listen, why don't you tell folks about your clinic and what you're doing, and we'll just have a conversation about it.
Wonderful. Well, as you said, we're located in Manhattan, and one of the sad facts is that there is very little psychiatric reform going on in New York City, in Manhattan, and throughout New York State. And so we see ourselves as an alternative, and that has given us a great deal of success, fortunately and unfortunately. Our center is called the New York Person-Centered Resource Center. You can see us online at nypcrc.org, nypcrc.org. And so following in your footsteps, we believe that our nation has a serious psychiatric crisis, and that a lot of the information clients, we like to call them clients instead of patients, the information our clients are given is based on poor science and research that we can't trust and advice that we can't trust. And so we seek to offer an alternative to that kind of thinking. And I would classify that kind of thinking as the medical model, or a destructive version of the medical model. So, I mean, should I go on and say, talk about what we
sure.
do?
Sure. Yes, well, go right ahead, Sartan, and tell folks what you do.
Sure. So, one of the terms that we like to use, and it's a term that people, I think, confuse because it's widely used, but the term is advocacy, that we see ourselves as psychiatric advocates. And when I say advocate, I mean in the truest sense that we want to advise, to inform, to guide, but never to direct or to make the decision for the client. And so in that way, just as you said earlier in the program, when people call me or contact me and want help either understanding what's been happening to them because of their psychiatric medications, or they want to get off their medications, or they're a family or friend or loved one who wants help getting their partner or family or friend off medications, the first and most important factor is to become an advocate for them. However, this is a problem, and you and I talked about this, Peter, and that is that a lot of people, most people I would say that contact me, don't understand that and don't understand the power of advocacy. And this is where I've discovered this phenomenon that we talked about that I call medical disempowerment. And what that means is that I find most people who are given psychiatric medications come to us and are in a state of seeking expert advice and expert direction and don't understand how to look internally to what maybe they feel and to seek someone who is a partner, an egalitarian partner, as opposed to a directive partner. And this is the really the biggest issue, the first issue that we have to tackle to help people to see that we will be an advocate for them, but not a leader of them. And I have to say it's not easy because most people want a leader, or at least I find that they're so trained that they need a leader. They don't know that there's something better and there's something that is more inclusive out there.
When you say a leader, you mean someone to give them specific directions on what to do rather than to explore with them what's in their best interest?
Exactly, Peter. In my ideal world, a psychiatrist would see a client, or any prescriber, any clinician for that matter, would see a client, and they would offer them a full description of the varieties of treatment options available. And as well as, and this is important, give them an honest assessment of the short and the long-term side effects of the medications to really inform them. I never see that happening.
Never is a big word, but I don't see it happening either. And I think with all the information we're getting now on the dangers of psychiatric drugs, I think that people who were given information about psychiatric drugs would be very reluctant to take them. Is that your sense of it too?
Well, I would say, for the most part, yes. I think the more important issue is that people are given the knowledge and then make the best choice they can with that knowledge. So I don't know. Maybe people would go on and take the medication, at least on a trial basis. Maybe they wouldn't. I hope they wouldn't because I don't see its usefulness in most cases. But aside from that, education is denied, and that creates a state of disempowerment. And that is, psychologically speaking, the first issue that must be overcome if someone wants to really truly withdraw from medication and lead a more free life that doesn't need to have an influence like medication.
Well, you're a psychologist, a PhD, you can't prescribe. How do you help a person overcome this sense of submissiveness toward the medical expert? What do you do?
It's very hard, Peter, but there's a few steps. The first one, the most difficult step, is actually getting someone to come see me. Most people that contact me who want to withdraw from drugs, I think, have a deep mistrust not only of psychiatrists, but of clinicians, of psychologists, social workers, counselors. And that's unfortunately for good reason, because people in our position, the non-prescribing professionals, have essentially jumped on the bandwagon of psychiatrists and really been seen and used as appendages to psychiatrists, simply supporting and backing up their beliefs. And that's unnecessary, and it's a shame, in particular because we spend a lot more time with our clients than psychiatrists do, and we have a lot more weekly, biweekly, twice weekly, sometimes more face-to-face experience, and we know what these medications are doing to them day by day. We can track it a lot more closely. And so, okay, backing up. So the first step is to get them to come in. If I can have someone actually make an appointment to come see me and sit down and talk, believe it or not, most of the time when they come in, they see what we have to offer and they can make an informed choice. The problem, though, is, as I said, is that a lot of people are afraid to see a non-prescriber. They really want a psychiatrist. Most people call me and say, do you know a psychiatrist who's available? Do you have someone on staff?
And when now, what do you do in terms of helping educate people about the psychiatric medications, about their rights, their privileges, and so on?
So, good question, Peter. So there's a few steps. The first step is helping them to see that I'm someone that's not here to manipulate them. And that's by a face-to-face meeting, coming in the office, sitting down. And that happens subtly, but it's very important. The second step, though, is just plain and simple literature, providing resources, websites, books, papers. And we have here a whole wide variety of resources at our disposal. And I sit down with clients, and I'll gear a package of information and resources, and I let them know this is the beginning of their education. And they need to see that that's really, it's rare in therapy, in psychotherapy, when you can have such a concrete action that is the first step to the process. But in these cases, it is that understanding the wide variety of voices and opinions is so important when wanting to take an alternative step. So education is the next, and that means just providing literature. And if it's a child, we'll gear it towards the family. And I'll try to make it so that it's things they can understand. Your books are one of the best resources we have because they're very approachable. But there's a large body of work. And so I spend a lot of time talking about literature and papers and books with clients and going over what they thought of it and recommending new ones. And it becomes an investigation for both of us.
So you help the patient, the client, become a student of their problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's a very exciting approach. Go ahead and tell us some more about that. I mean, how do people feel when now they're supposed to kind of be reading for themselves and learning for themselves?
Well, it's interesting. There's two camps in that. Some people are already well-informed and actually much more informed than I am, and they're recommending things to me. And for them, it's exciting to see that their knowledge is valued by a professional. So that can become very useful, and sometimes they'll even spend time helping them interpret what they've read in ways that are they have a bigger meaning. I had a client recently who read something about brain damage caused by some of the medications he was taking, and he was very afraid that he had this brain damage, but with a closer perusal of the writing, I was able to help him see that this was a state that he can move through. It's not a permanent state necessarily, and that gave him a great deal of hope. So it's that kind of thing with one population. The other population, people who are brand new to literature, it can be an uphill battle in the sense they're just not used to professionals offering them this kind of so-called inside data. But when they see that it's given to them in an appropriate way, in a way that's accessible, because there's a lot of writing out there, yours included, that is very accessible to the lay person. And when they enter in that way, then they say, wow, this is really something that I've just never known was out there, and I feel empowered to know it exists.
It's very striking to me how often in the medical legal cases that I see, and then sometimes in the people who just come to me for help, that a family member has taken it upon himself or herself, and it's very frequently a woman, it's very frequently a wife or a mother, even the mother of a grown child, offspring, who's now an adult, has gone into the literature, developed a knowledge of the specific drug, maybe Zyprexa or Risperdal or one of the really serious antipsychotic drugs or the SSRI antidepressants, and has developed more knowledge about the drug and its adverse effects and its relationship to what the patient's going through than the prescribing psychiatrist has. And they will sometimes have the courage even to bring this material to the psychiatrist, who almost always reacts to it with resentment and hostility without wanting to accept that this information can be obtained without the magic of the medical degree. But it is entirely possible now for lay persons to educate themselves, and by focusing on one or two drugs, whereas the psychiatrist or the pediatrician or the internist has got hundreds to deal with, by focusing on one or two drugs to have far more knowledge about, especially the risks and the harm, than the prescriber. It's commonplace.
Definitely. Now, I see also that we have to be careful with that, because I do get clients who come in who are in an unstable place, and then they'll bring the literature to their professional, and the professional shushes it off as, oh, this is just part of their poor thinking. And so one thing I try to do, and I'm learning about this as I go, but that is to really not encourage clients to present the literature to the professionals until they've really shown the other professional, let's say the prescriber, the psychiatrist, until they've shown that person that they really are stable over a period of time. I find that if the psychiatrist sees them in a stable state, they're much more willing to give those perspectives some sort of, at least, you know, basic understanding, basic perusal.
But you got to see the psychiatrist as a person. The prescriber is a person who needs your reassurance by the demonstration that your behavior is stable and your thoughts and your emotions are under control, so that person can feel secure enough to accept your suggestion that you work on withdrawing from the meds.
That's beautifully said. That's an important step.
But a hard one, very hard one for people.
I think for us that comes later on down the road.
Okay.
The next step after the education, though, which ties into this, is, and this is so important, is corralling, unifying all of the client's external resources. Namely, I'm talking about family, friends, partners, loved ones, whoever is close in that person's life. The next step is to get them on board with what we're doing and with this new way of thinking, even help them get educated. I had a situation where a whole family came in the other day, and we spent a session educating them with literature and readings that they could understand, and that would be an aid into what their child or their family member was going through. I know that's something you talk about a lot, Peter, including family.
Yes, absolutely so. Family, for people going through withdrawal, if it's going to be a serious withdrawal, I always involve the family in the process. So there's a number of reasons for that. One is that people going through withdrawal may not recognize when they're having an adverse mental or behavioral reaction. They may just think they're really, really angry at their husband, or really, really want to divorce their wife, or really have terrible children. But in fact, it's an abrupt onset that probably has to do with their going through a recent stepping down of the dose. And they need family to be able to talk to them about this. They need family to be able to get in touch with me. So in my practice, if it's at all a problem, if it looks like this withdrawal is going to be any kind of a problem, or if the person is under 21, I always try to involve the family as thoroughly as possible, including, as you did, having a visit or two.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, go ahead and tell us some more about what you're doing.
So once the family or the support system is in place, then the next step, and by support system I include myself also, that they're trusting me and seeing me as an advocate, the next step is to create a plan. And you could call it a treatment plan, you could call it plan of action. I mean, the term doesn't matter. This is not something that's arbitrary or is externally created. It needs to be a very personal plan. For some people, just having a significant period of time of studying the literature is enough as a next step. For a lot of people, it's understanding what they've done or what kind of withdrawal they've done in the past and how they can do differently. Most of the time, what I see is people go off way too fast, but more than that, they just don't really even consider that withdrawing is going to have a serious toll on their body, and they need to track what they're feeling, track what they're doing, understand how they're living, in addition to just slowly reducing this medication. So sitting down, and actually, we don't have to, but writing down on paper what the goals they have, what they hope to accomplish. And everyone, and this is different. For some people, they don't want to write it down. We just talk about it. For some people, it's drawings. For some people, it's a detailed script. For everyone, it's different. But to concretize the plan of withdrawal and also to include the family in this concrete step, if possible, so that everyone knows what's going on. One of the tools that I hear a lot of people who do successful withdrawal mentioning is keeping a journal, a withdrawal journal, where they talk about, they know daily what they're feeling emotionally, physically, and tracking it. It's a great resource, and they'll bring it in to me. I'll say, oh, what happened here? And they said, well, I was feeling as if I wasn't thinking right on this particular day, and we look back, and it was just after one withdrawal step, and then it's possible you're going too fast. And I mean, this is not rocket science.
Now, is the prescriber involved in these withdrawal decisions at some point?
That's the next step. So in this plan, here's the interesting thing. So what usually comes up is that the client needs the support of a prescriber in order to maintain or to enact whatever withdrawal plan they create. And so this is where the next big hurdle comes up. So most of the time, the psychiatrist, the prescribers involved, don't really want to take part in this process. Most of the time, that's what I've seen. They don't want to help the person reduce. They want them to maintain or to change the medication. And so this is where the individual needs to really be in an empowered place to make a choice. And this is where we can't tell them what to do. All I can do is be the advocate and advise. A lot of times they'll want me to get involved and to essentially approach the psychiatrist or whoever's prescribing and to make a claim for why this person should withdraw. And unfortunately, that's usually not a good idea, we've found, because it simply, there becomes a war between us and the psychiatrist. But what I have found is that if the person is living in a new way, maybe taking some new action in their life as part of their treatment plan, let's say going to work more often or school or something, and their behavior is stable, and they have a new therapeutic relationship that's developing, and the family is involved, and they have a treatment plan, and they're educating themselves, if all these steps come together, then that's something that the psychiatrist will make note of. And that's when the person can become an ally. And that's when, and this needs to happen over time, the client can approach the psychiatrist and say, look at all these things I'm doing, look at all these influences in my life, I'm ready, can you help me? Now, that said, very often they still will not help, unfortunately. And that's where more we go back to our original plan, and more information, more research, maybe you need to consider looking for a new psychiatrist, one that will recognize all the progress. Maybe there needs to be new ways to communicate with a psychiatrist. There's a lot of different options available, but the key is to see this as a plan that's progressing as opposed to a roadblock that can't be overcome. And that's what we as advocates do. And that's what everyone in someone's life, whether you're a professional or not, can do.
Is there much opportunity for people to decide, well, I've got you working with me, why don't I just go to my GP, my family doc, tell them my situation, they can help me with the prescription, give me medical coverage, give you medical coverage, does that happen?
Oh, for sure, yeah, definitely. And I think more and more general practitioners are willing to do that. If they see that someone is stable and has all these resources around other people, and sometimes they'll even call me, and they see I'm, you know, somewhat of a coherent professional, they will come on board. This can become a struggle if a conflict is created between the existing psychiatrists. So that's the key, I think, to not create conflict. You said something earlier, it was so beautiful, they are people too. The psychiatrists, the prescribers are people, they have their own needs. We don't agree with their philosophies necessarily, but we have to acknowledge that in their minds they're doing the best they can, I believe, or they believe they are, and I respect that. So it's a process, and this is the next hurdle. After this hurdle comes the one you'd mentioned before, which... Are you there, Peter?
Yeah, I'm just listening. Sorry. I just find what you're saying interesting, so I'm not... I'm doing more listening than usual, Sardin. But you were saying that's when what I mentioned before. What were you referring to specifically for the audience?
Specifically the issue of can the psychological factor behind the what has brought the person to the medication, and that's the biggest hurdle, and that then arises that brings up, because, well, let me give you a case example. I have a client who says he wants to withdraw from medication. He's had a number of hospitalizations. He's that was a year ago. He's past that. His family is supportive. He's ready to go back to work. He's ready to relieve a new life, but in reality, his day-to-day living is not what it could be. He's really sleeping in a lot more, and he has a job that is not as demanding as it could be. And so there are some psychological factors at hand that are preventing him from being fully empowered and being fully showing that his health, that he's healthy and stable, and being able to really prove to people that there are objective reasons why a change can be made. And so this is where just good old psychotherapy comes in. And I think a lot of people in this situation aren't familiar with what good old psychotherapy is. And it requires two people sitting down, talking about feelings, what people have experienced, what traumas they've had, and how that relates to their present state, and how they can consider new ways to overcome that those traumas. So in the end, the whole thing comes full circle, and it is just about good psychotherapy, good counseling, if you will. I think those two words are interchangeable. And yet, to get to that point requires a lot of earlier steps. I think all these early steps are ways to help people to feel safe enough to dig in and do that psychotherapeutic work.
People can feel so unsafe about coming off psychiatric drugs. You've gotten at that partially, talking about the way people submit to medical authority. And they've also been burned when they've tried to come off on their own and done it abruptly or without guidance, and they end up getting burned, in effect, emotionally. And it's very, very distressing to them, and they're very unsure about beginning again. And they've been told by, if it's a parent, by the teachers that your kid needs the drugs, or they've been told by their own psychiatrist that, see, you need the drugs. So you're running up against a whole huge establishment. Do you feel vulnerable to attack in what you're doing? Maybe we could talk briefly about that and then go to break.
Sure. I certainly do feel vulnerable, mainly because there's very few people doing what we do. However, I also know that we're not doing anything that is outside the scope of our professions. And I think the bigger issue is people in our profession have not stepped back and made their own decision, because every person I talk to, every professional I talk to, when they hear what I've said to you today, they say, yeah, that makes logical sense. There's one exception to that. Let me know if I'm going on too long. And that is for people who have a fundamental belief in a biological or genetic basis for mental illness. Now, if you have that kind of a belief system, that's usually where there's very little room for debate, because you think there's something fundamentally wrong with the biology in the client. I don't. I can't agree with that. And so partly because I don't agree with that, that frees me up. I mean, I would even say that, let's say if there is, for argument's sake, a biological basis to mental illness, human beings are enormously adaptable and have the enormous ability to overcome any possible predisposition. That's all it is a predisposition. It's not a disposition.
Well, I'd take a step even further and say, if a person does have a biochemical imbalance in their brain that's causing them to be emotionally disturbed, the last thing they need is a psychiatric drug, which is going to give them multiple unpredictable additional biochemical imbalances. So, you know, just cutting to the heart of it, the whole notion that because you might have a biochemical imbalance, you should take a psychiatric drug. In fact, where we do have real disease processes going on, like Parkinsonism or Alzheimer's or, say, a hypothyroid crisis, the last thing that you want to do to somebody with a genuine biological problem causing psychiatric manifestations is to load them up with psychiatric drugs. We have more and more literature on this. Sartan, we'll go to break. And when we come back with Sartan Weinrob, we'll have more of an exchange of both of our opinions and both of our experiences in this area. Thank you, Sartan.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, your conscience of psychiatry. Maybe not yours, maybe your psychiatrist's conscience of psychiatry. On our website, it's my professional website that's on Facebook. I don't know a lot about that stuff, but my wife runs a wonderful Peter Breggin professional website. And we put up the other day a statement that occurred to me while I was chatting with my wife. And the statement is that the era of patient compliance is over. The era of patient choice has begun. That one little item put up on my one lonely professional website got over 1,000 likes. People are responding to the notion of empowerment. And that's what Sartan Weinraub in Manhattan and his clinic is all about. Now, under my comment that the age of patient compliance is over and the age or era and the era of patient choice has begun, my wife wrote in below it, your psychiatrist is not the boss of you. And she got all of these delightful responses to it. Why should this be radical? Are we not persons? Are we not individuals? Are we not supposed to control our own medical treatment? Psychiatry is ages behind medicine in general, which ironically puts a higher priority on patient self-determination than does psychiatry, where patient self-determination is the key to life. And Sartan is working really hard to develop a new model for non-medical people, counselors, therapists, clinical psychologists like himself, clinical social workers, to really step up to taking more responsibility instead of just enforcing patient compliance as they may have been taught a long time ago. Sartan, take over there.
Yes. I actually used to work at a psychiatric hospital here in New York City, and I had a caseload of over 50 clients. The majority were diagnosed with schizophrenia and splatterings of bipolar disorder. But it was the most difficult part of that job was not the clients, having a 50-client caseload. It was not even the dreary hospital setting. It was feeling so subservient to the psychiatrists who were the true bosses of the environment. So I've seen firsthand what it's like on the inside. And while they're good people, I respect them, and I respect that they believe they're doing good work, there is an element of dominance and what I call medical dominance, where they see themselves as the dictators, and there is very little room for influence from others. And in this, in the work of mental health, I don't believe there is room for that kind of thinking any longer. We've learned that no one is stable without collaboration. You can give someone medication, send them out to the community, but they're in the community. And so I think, going back to your quote and to what Ginger was saying, the time has come for collaboration and true advocacy. I think psychiatrists are and should be the best advocate for their client. And by advocate, I mean those seeking true, a wider range of knowledge to be shared. And there was an article a few months ago in the New York Times about how psychiatrists are losing their livelihood. I think you saw that, Peter. And what's interesting, though, is that what I'm advocating is a way for psychiatrists to increase their livelihood, to really return to the basic roots, not just of psychotherapy, but of knowledge and passing on of information that can lead to healing. And I think that this is an avenue to invigorate the profession, not to detract from it. But it's going to require the admitting some great mistruths. And then mainly I'm referring to the research and the way that drugs are approved by the FDA and the way that drug companies support most of the research that's done to support the drug being approved by the FDA. I mean, it goes on and on. I think those big world manipulations are going to have to be addressed before the profession can really cleanse itself and return to a place of advocacy.
Yeah, one of the striking things about the FDA is that when they they have these studies that they require, they're usually only 4, 5, or 6 weeks long to start with, and they're, of course, completely managed and manipulated by the drug company, but they don't even require any kind of detailed look at the effects of the drugs adversely on mental function. For example, there's a long now established research behind neuropsychological testing to pick up whether somebody has brain dysfunction that's being caused by an injury or a drug. And there's no requirement for patients being given these drugs to have neuropsychological testing, and I've never seen it done as a part of getting the drug approved. And then when reports come into the when reports are published again and again about things like atrophy of the brain, of patients on Ritalin, of patients on the antipsychotic drugs, of patients on the benzodiazepines, it's more and more coming in about outright brain damage. The FDA turns a completely blind eye. Now, if you're getting a sore nose from a drug, they'll put it in if they've heard a few reports. If they've heard a few reports that your skin's getting itchy, they'll put it in. But out comes really systematic research showing long-term brain injury from drugs, and it never gets into the FDA label. So we're into, you know, the FDA's materials on what patients should be told, or the FDA's guidebooks on what families should know. So we really have to talk about a more serious, honest, and honorable science that we need to deliver to our patients. Of course, I've been devoting much of my life to writing those books, like Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. And it's so good to have you aboard coming at this from a clinician's viewpoint and doing this work. I think it's courageous and admirable, truly courageous and admirable, what you're doing, Sartan Weinrob.
Thank you, Peter. You know, in the work that I do, and we talked about this before, the biggest hurdle is that first step when someone calls me and they want a psychiatrist and they ask me, do you have a psychiatrist? And I say, there's really no one I can recommend in my area in Manhattan. And they say, well, what can I offer them? And it's almost as if over the phone they want me to give them a synopsis of how I can cure them. And in my mind, what I'm usually thinking is, that's the problem right there, that there is this mentality of quick fix, of get me to the right doctor and I'll be stable. And yet time and again, we've seen it doesn't work that way. And I don't know anyone who's ever taken psychiatric medications, except for maybe a short-term, I don't know, bout of depression over a breakup or something, that's ever had an experience where there was a quick fix that worked. And yet time and again, people want this. And maybe quick fix is even a harsh statement, but I'm really saying they're looking for a professional to direct them. And the bigger reality is that I think there is no professional that can direct them except for towards their own awareness and their own deeper insight and their own awareness of what they're feeling and what they need. And this is the catch-22 of psychiatry, because it's probably those feelings. I imagine if some of these people that contact me, if they look at their feelings, there's a lot of pain and anguish, and it's very hard to look at those feelings. And so it's easier to medicate them and to essentially stop them up.
Yeah. Well, very sadly, psychiatry sells helplessness. The patient comes in and says, Doc, I feel helplessly, overwhelmingly depressed. And instead of the psychiatrist starting a conversation about empowerment, the psychiatrist goes into agreement and says you are helpless because you have a biochemical imbalance. And instead of you being able to take charge of your life, understand what's going on, overcome your depression, live a marvelous life, I've got a drug to sort of hold you in place because you are helpless. So this whole medical model plays on the suffering individual's worst fears, that they are not responsible for their lives, that they can't take over, that they can't work their way out of this, that therapy won't do it, counseling won't do it, religion won't do it, love, family life won't do it, figuring out what one wants out of life and pursuing it won't do it because it's like crossed wires in my head and I need to be tinkered with. It is so disempowering, and that's what a good part of what you're running up against. That's a huge part of it, and I think it's very, very honorable of you to be leading the way among the clinical professions, the psychologists, social workers, non-prescribing nurses, counselors, all the folks who work with people and saying, listen, let's start educating our patients instead of insisting they follow the doctor's orders, which never set anyone free.
You know, as I think about it in greater detail, I feel as if when these people call me and they want that fix, I wish I could give it to them. I wish that I could say, listen, I see exactly what's going on. You're probably, I'm just going to say that in most cases there's a very clear larger problem. For example, they're an adult living at home for too long, or they're in a career. They've never had the chance to find a career that was satisfying, or something very big, very overt. However, just saying those things, giving them that quick answer, which to me is an honest answer, doesn't help either, in that a true understanding of that problem requires a lot of emotional work, emotional dredging up and consideration and clarification. And so these are not simple problems, and I guess angry or frustrated when I see professionals making complex problems simple and selling that. It feels.
Well, I want to really agree with you. You know, as a psychiatrist who spends a lot of time withdrawing people from medication, many of the people that I take off of just say two drugs, maybe a Prozac and Xanax, they may spend months and months gradually coming off, while they work on the kinds of issues that originally got them into difficulty, where they weren't taking good care of themselves, they weren't developing their own lives, where childhood issues kept rearing their heads and overcoming them without their realizing it, where they were operating on self-defeating lifestyles or attitudes, not trusting themselves, not trusting love, not trusting they could have creative work, not valuing themselves, all these issues that all human beings struggle with, may have to be dealt with in a very gentle and caring and kind longer term while the person gradually reduces the medication. Other people can do it more simply and quickly at times, but the longer you've been on the drugs and the more you're on and the more issues you had before starting them, you know, the more you need to be patient with yourself and with the therapy or counseling process while you come off the meds.
There's another issue that comes up to me, which I think actually in the long run is probably the most difficult situation, and that is when someone has a financial reward for maintaining their diagnosis. And I think you know what I'm referring to, Peter, I mean specifically, and not to say that I'm against it, but that a lot of times people come to me and they're on Social Security, SSI, SSD, these kinds of incomes, which are necessary for their survival. At the same time, their maintenance of their symptomology makes that financial support viable. And this is a whole other huge area that our culture will have to address at some point.
Yes, people rarely come off of long-term disability once they've gotten it. And some people thrive. They just put that in one pocket and say, okay, I'm technically disabled, but I'm going to go out there and enjoy my life. Other people live the lifestyle. And it also happens with children, as you know, where parents develop an income from having a number of children declared ADHD and getting a putting them on drugs, which is usually part of qualifying, and ending up, with long-term disabled children because it fits into an income pattern. Interestingly enough, I've even noticed it on occasion with patients of mine who have inherited a monthly income, And it sometimes takes the edge off of their actually developing their lives. It's as if, to some extent, we need a certain amount of pressure often to really thrive. Not that I'm advocating poverty, yeah, but I'm advocating the need to stand independently and in a self-determined fashion.
It's a very difficult situation. I have clients that if they were to, let's say, walk away from their Social Security benefits, they would be destitute. At the same time, those benefits, it's clear to me those benefits and the receiving of them prevents them from actually exerting potential effort and ability. And it breaks my heart. I don't.
Aren't most of them required to go and get checkups with their psychiatrist to stay on these disabilities? And they end up needing to take drugs at the psychiatrist's advice to stay on the disability?
Luckily, in New York State, I've not seen that as much. What is required is that they have yearly or bi-yearly, I'm not quite sure how often, reviews, medical reviews, and very often that can be done by a psychologist. Could be initially that was required. I don't know. I can't answer that.
So psychologists can do these yearly evaluations,
yes,
but most of them are going to behave like psychiatrists.
Yes, that's right. I mean, when people come to me for an initial evaluation for Social Security, I'm always quite skeptical and quite concerned. It's something that's very hard to deal with because I see the long-term consequences. At the same time,
I know you're devoting yourself, Sartan, to encouraging professionals to themselves to get empowered, because obviously not just the clients and patients but the professionals have been disempowered in not believing in themselves and thinking that they have to just simply push patients to comply with doctor's orders. And you have a group of professionals you're working with. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure,
and they're going to be at our conference. You're going to be at our conference with some of your colleagues. That'll be April 13th, 14th, and 15th of this coming year in Syracuse again. You were there last year, and you'll be back. And I think you'll be bringing some colleagues with you, I believe.
Yes, definitely. We have a small but growing group here. We have 9 therapists, psychotherapists. There's no psychiatrists here, but we have psychologists, social workers, mental health counselors, art therapists, and one or two licensed psychoanalysts, which is a new license here in New York State. But what's great is that there's a common theme that binds us all here, and that's what makes us a center or a clinic, and that is that we all believe in what are called humanistic principles of psychology, humanistic principles that relate to what is called the person-centered approach, which is the current term for the work of Carl Rogers, a very famous American psychologist. So, again, being humanistic is a unique philosophy here in New York City, where most psychotherapists are either psychoanalytically driven or cognitive behaviorally oriented. So we believe it's because of our humanistic philosophy that we are drawn towards a greater awareness of the manipulations of psychiatry and medication. So
yeah, you and I are so much on the same page. I don't talk about my training tape very often. Sounds like a reasonable place to bring it up, but I've done a training tape that can be obtained on my website on Bregan.com. It's called Empathic Therapy Training. And you were there and you participated and critiqued from the audience. I had a number of professionals critiquing. And the whole point about good therapy for me is about really honestly, honorably engaging the person you're with in a real conversation about their lives and what's good for them and what they want to pursue and what's standing in their way. It's a real honest, forthright engagement. I think that is so key, and people deserve to have that. But in psychiatry now, you get a canned narrative that the psychiatrist gives to you that's practically out of the, if not exactly out of, the drug representative, the drug salesman's playbook. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're going to hear. You're not going to have a genuine engagement about what's going on in your life. And I'm sure you're doing that. And that's a real contribution for people.
You know, you asked me earlier, am I concerned about being vulnerable to the powers that be because of my alternative stance? And I have to say there is a concern. But my bigger concern is not that I'll be attacked or persecuted, have my license taken away, but that we'll just be ignored and our numbers will decrease. That's really a bigger fear. There are very few humanistically oriented psychotherapists in New York, in New York City. There's very few people who are willing to question medications here. So another part of our plan is we have to increase the amount of clinicians who are thinking this way and just acknowledging that there are other ways to deal with medications. And I'm hoping that this program and your work, Peter, and our continued work will help that. That is a side goal. We need more professionals who are humanistically and reform-oriented.
Yes, Sartin and I are working together. Sartin is an active member of the our therapy for the study of empathic therapy. And we're looking forward, Sartin, to you building a larger and larger contingent in New York City and making a part of the general outreach that we're doing in empathic therapy. Give your phone number and if you would like,
yes,
so folks can get in touch with you. And I hope both the clients will get in touch with you, potential clients.
Please.
And I hope that professionals will get in touch with you.
Yeah, in addition to clients contacting us, we also have opportunities for professionals who want professional supervision around these issues. If you're someone working in a hospital, a clinic, and you're questioning these issues, and you'd like to have more support around that, we can be a resource for you. So you can contact us at area code 212-989-6086, 212-989-6086, or on the internet at nypcrc.org, nypcrc.org. I think that's one of the best ways to increase the influence of professionals is to provide supervision or clinical support to them. That's something that's greatly lacking in this city and in our country. So we have a number of therapists here who are trained in that and who are ready to work with professionals.
Let me give our listeners the source, my best sources that I've written for the whole issue of withdrawing from psychiatric drugs. Both of my newest books have whole chapters on how to withdraw from psychiatric medications. Medication Madness, which is in paperback and readily available on line from all the standard sources, and you can also get through your bookstore. If they don't have it in, they'll get it. Medication Madness in paperback has a chapter on withdrawing from psychiatric medication. It's something that you could copy and share with your therapist or with your prescriber. And in addition, we have my book, came out the same year, just very recently, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, which is a really medical textbook. It's very in-depth, but it too has a readily accessible chapter on how to withdraw from psychiatric medications. And then a little older, if you want a whole book, is Your Drug May Be Your Problem. Which I wrote with a co-author, Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Drugs. So there's the information. We haven't gone into detail today about how to withdraw from psychiatric drugs. We're talking rather about the processes that therapists can offer you and about other therapists learning these processes and about empowering yourself through education rather than going through the details. Sartin, 1 minute left. You got something for 30 seconds that you'd like to say to your colleagues or clients out in the world?
Yes, I want to say that if you've heard us and if you have some inclination towards what we're thinking, please come and at least explore. Just as with my clients, with all of us, expanding our knowledge is the most important thing. If you expand knowledge, whether you agree or not, you've increased your ability to make well-rounded choices, and that is the road to health.
In the coming year, folks, my wife Ginger and I are working very hard on getting out a new book on how to come off psychiatric drugs that will discuss this whole collaborative process between the prescriber and the therapist and the patient and the family. And we're doing a lot more work now to communicate to the public, to you, about how dangerous these drugs are long term. This is Dr. Peter Breggin, the conscience of psychiatry. I want to thank Sartin Weinraub for his genuine courage and his high ethics in putting the patient's interests first in person person-centered therapy. Thank you, Sartan Weinraub, and thank you, all of you brave enough to listen and to work with us.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.